The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Oh, I'm just introducing her. You don't have to do that. Good evening. My name is Adrian Pruitt, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to the Free Library of Philadelphia's lecture series this evening. Tonight's speaker is the Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer Natalie Angier, and I'm very excited to be able to introduce her. Before we begin, I have to ask you to please turn off your cell phones, your pagers, if you need to unwrap any little crinkly candies, pop any champagne corks, whatever you have to do that's going to make noise, please go ahead and get that out of the way. And I'd also like to mention some upcoming events here at the library. Please join us to hear cosmologist Paul Davies discuss his latest book, Cosmic Jackpot, Why Our Universe is Just Right for Life. That's this Friday, the 11th, at noon. And we'll also have nutritionist Marion Nestle on what to eat on June 28th. Actually, I think it's Nestle, pardon me, on June 28th, and Natalie Angier's colleague at the New York Times, Gina Collada, for Rethinking Thin, the New Science of Weight Loss, on July 12th. Natalie Angier has written for Discover Magazine, Time, The Atlantic Monthly, Savvy, Cosmopolitan, and a score of other journals and anthologies. In 1990, she became a science writer for the New York Times, and in 1991, she won the Pulitzer Prize for her beat reporting there. She has also been awarded the American Association for the Advancement of Science Prize for excellence in science journalism, and the Lewis Thomas Award for Distinguished Writing in the Life Sciences, among many other honors. This fall, she will begin a 5-year term as the Andrew D. White Professor at Large at Cornell University, a position that has the distinction of previously being held by such diverse contributors to cultural achievement as Jane Goodall, Oliver Sacks, and John Cleese. Over nearly 30 years of writing about science, Natalie Angier has covered nearly every subject imaginable. Her books include Natural Obsessions, a behind-the-scenes look at the high-pressure world of cancer research, and The Beauty of the Beastly, in which she examines underappreciated wonders of nature, like cockroaches, parasites, dung beetles, and the surprisingly sordid details of dolphin sex. Her third book, Woman, An Intimate Geography, is an eloquent celebration of female biology that was named one of the best books of the year by National Public Radio. What all of her books share is an articulate, witty enthusiasm for the infinite marvels of the natural world. She reminds us of something that we tend to forget after grade school, that the world around us is interesting, and that figuring out how it works is fun. Science is not merely a list of elements to be memorized, recited at test time, and promptly forgotten. It is actually poetry in motion. In her new book, The Canon, A Whirligig Tour Through the Beautiful Basics of Science, she provides readers with an engaging guide to the building blocks of our universe. In compelling, lucid prose, Natalie Angier covers the fundamental principles of all of the major scientific disciplines: physics, chemistry, biology, geology, and astronomy, and invites us to rediscover the joy of rich ideas. The Canon is essential reading for anyone who wants to know how the world works. Please join me in welcoming Natalie Angier.
Thank you for that applause, which I deserve. Not for my writing, but because it has been. Now can you hear me? Because this is important. It's been 10 years since I have had a root canal. Applause. Well, you know, I know a lot of you aren't impressed by this, but I can tell you that for me, this extended period of tooth happiness is a real achievement. I call it my smile stone. because I have these terrible teeth and a tragic dental history. I've had 9 root canals, 12 crowns, 2 bridges, and approximately 4,328 cavities filled. I've spent so much time in a dental chair that I think they should endow one in my name. Except that I'm a terrible patient, and I think I gave rise to this myth, and it is a myth, that dentists have a high rate of suicide. In fact, this is actually true, that one time after I had one of my periodic meltdowns at the dentist's office, they put up a sign that said essentially, you know, bad dental patients, you need them like you need another hole in the head. So I have since, though, in the last 10 years, I've been taking much better care of my teeth, really diligently taking care of my teeth. And that involves constantly fighting against something called dental plaque. And I bring this up for a reason. Dental plaque, which is something I learned about in the course of researching this book, is an amazing phenomenon. It's not just, okay, you know, bacteria cause cavities and all those other problems and swelling of the gums and so on. But what you may not realize is that it's not just bacteria. What it is this community of 600 different species of bacteria. All of them, according to Bonnie Basser, who's this wonderful microbiologist at Princeton, all of them as different from each other as Martians would be from humans. So you have one species that might be able to metabolize the sugar residues on your teeth. Another is good at clinging to the enamel. The next one releases these abrasive chemicals that begin scraping away at the enamel. You can't see any of these little microbes. I have a chapter on scale and talk about that. They're very tiny, of course. If you had a pin and you look at the pin head, which is about 2 millimeters across, and you wallpaper that with these microbes, you'd have about 20 million of them. But you can feel them. If you run your finger across your teeth like that, you'll feel that kind of slime. That is your dental plaque. The important thing is that you get rid of them every night, or you try your best, you brush, as I do, for at least 2 minutes a night, and you floss with 3 different kinds of floss, and you use Listerine and so on, which 99.9% of them are killed. The next morning, they're all back again. And they're all back, not just sort of coming and going, they're back in that same structure of 600 cooperating species of dental plaque microbes. And so I think if you continue to just pound away at them, you can actually make a real dent in keeping away the dentist. So I haven't had any problems in 10 years since I've been very diligent. Now I know why. It's because you really have to keep at it day after day after day. So you may say, well, so what? Well, so what is these bacteria, which are one of billions of species of bacteria. They don't even begin to know how many different kinds of bacteria there are. They are the salt of the earth. They are supporting us all. You would not believe the importance of bacteria. I want to just read you a little bit about these wonderful bacteria. So you have, you can't possibly sterilize yourself. It's really impossible. You are covered with bacteria. There's maybe 500 million of them blanketing your skin. It's this kind of teeming microtropolis of several thousand different strains. Billions more happily fill all those moist orifices of your body. The mouth, of course, the nose, ears, vagina, urethra, anus, lower intestines. When you breathe, you're breathing in these vortices of airborne bacteria. But the great majority of them are harmless. They're really not capable of colonizing your lungs and making you sick. And in fact, many of these bacteria are essential to our survival. They feed us. They cook for us. They clean up our messes. By fixing nitrogen into a form fit for plants, and by fixing that means making it something that we can use. You know, the atmosphere is filled with nitrogen, but it's not in a form that we can actually use, that we need to build our cells. So plants have these root-dwelling bacteria that do that for us. Once ingested, our meals are digested with the help of intestinal bacteria. Something like 99 out of 100 cells in your intestines are actually bacterial cells. They flourish in that warmth and plenty of our plumbing. And in return, they synthesize vitamins for us, help extract from our food essential nutrients that would otherwise pass through unclaimed. Wherever you go, there they are, doubtily doing the world's dirty work. If you dig up a gram of soil and pinch of it, you're looking at thousands of different species, detritus recyclers, breaking up the dumped and the dead and making them fit for new life. I mean, we think of things like earthworms and dung beetles and other things, flies, but actually when you get right down to it, it's the bacteria that do it all for us. So what is it about bacteria that makes them so wonderful? They're cells. The cells are, this is one of the fundamental principles that I discuss in my chapter on biology. Cells are really the unit of life. They are, I mean, the reason why we work so well, we all work so well, is because we're built of cells. And one of the things that happens is you read about stem cell debate, cells, you know, and people, I think, don't have a sense of cells, what they are, how big they are, or why we're made up of them instead of just like sheets of material. So you ask these questions, why are we made up of cells? Well, it turns out that one of the things that cells are great at doing is they actually make, they kind of are little islands of stability in an otherwise chaotic environment. So what you have, if you crack open any cell, you crack open a bacterial cell or a cell of your liver or kidneys or any cell you care to, it's going to have a very similar kind of geography inside. And one of the things that it's doing is, by having that little border around it, all the things inside of it can be controlled. Read you something else that I actually think is an idea most people don't quite see the beauty of, because there have been cells on Earth nonstop for 3.8 billion years. It was such a successful thing to arise that ever since then it's been all cells all the time. So the beauty and power of the cell, and one of the core insights to emerge from modern biology, is a cell confronts the harshness and instability of the outside world by making itself a haven. A cell contains all the tools it needs to preserve order and stability within its borders, to keep its interior recesses warm and wet and chemically balanced. And in this equilibrated, level-headed setting, the cell's vast labor force of proteins and enzymes will operate at peak performance and so sustain the cell in its state of mild grace. There is nothing more natural than a cell. The natural world, after all, is full of them. At the same time, a cell is the ultimate act of artifice, a climate-controlled limousine with cushioned seats and a private bar cruising through a mad desert storm. So one of the principles that I discuss is the importance of the cell and why it's small, and also the second part of that, the flip side of it, and getting back to our story of plaque bacteria, is although bacteria are single-celled organisms, meaning that each one is kind of autonomous, the thing that makes the plaque community so amazing is that they communicate with each other. And the other thing that happened that was revolutionary development is that cells spend a lot of time eavesdropping on each other, gossiping with each other, nagging each other, bullying each other. Half of the genes in our cells, and this is one of the discoveries of the Genome Project that was kind of striking, half of the genes are devoted to communicating with other cells. So you have this, on the one hand, the autonomy of the cell, on the other hand, this constant communication among them so they can coordinate with each other. And with these two basic principles, you have everything that you need to make this vast panoply of life on Earth. And it's kind of, it's really amazing. And I talk about what's inside the cell, the sort of the fundamental parts of the cell, and what you need to know about genes and so on. But ultimately, I'm a real fan of the cell. And I think that if you understand the cell, you kind of can build on that and understand pretty much anything about biology. One of the ideas about this book the reason I wrote it is, as somebody who's been covering science for many years, I'm always having to write about the news. And it's true, there's a lot of news in science, and it's exciting. But the truth is that most people don't have the foundations on which all of those results are coming. They don't sort of know the basics, or if they learned them, they forgot them, maybe, you know, actively so, because they hated it so much. Everybody seems to have flunked high school chemistry. It's an amazing phenomenon. It's almost a 100% flunk rate if you talk to people. So they forgot, like, what exactly is a molecule? What's an atom? What is, you know, what is a chemical bond? All of these basic things on which all of the science news is going on, people don't know. So what I try to do in the book is give people that kind of foundation, a few basic concepts in every discipline, that if you grasp them, you really can consider yourself fairly scientifically literate. You're not going to be somebody who has this kind of information. You're not going to have the working knowledge of a scientist, but you will be able to follow things and ask the right questions, and most important, feel like you own it, that you're not intimidated by it, and that you can laugh at it. And one of the things I try to do in the book is have a lot of humor, which I see as the great emulsifier to make people feel that science is your friend, because actually it is. It's, you know, we own it. Do you realize how many billions of dollars of in tax dollars go to support science? You own it, so you might as well sort of take advantage of that and become at least moderately familiar with it. And these are the basic concepts that if you grasp them, I think you'll be in pretty good shape. So how did I do it? What I did was, and I actually, my husband is also a science writer, and so we kind of brainstormed this together, and we also did a lot of the interviewing together. So what we did was we just went around and talked to, I don't know how many scientists, hundreds of them, and asked them, what do you wish the public understood about science? And, you know, on the general side, about science and how to think scientifically, and more specifically, in your discipline, if you were giving a class, what would you want your students, you know, introductory class in your discipline, what would you want them to remember when they actually left your, you know, the day after finals? What would you wish that they would remember? And so we kind of kept hammering away at that until we started hearing similar themes coming up again and again. Then we knew we kind of had what we needed to make the book. So how it's organized by the sort of how to think scientifically and why it's important. And I think it's important. And I also think, I don't know about you, but I tend to be a very emotional person and sometimes not very sensible and overreactive. And I think that's true with a lot of people. And when I start thinking about things scientifically and start working through a problem, it grounds me and kind of makes me see things a little bit more clearly. Star Trek, the original series, I had my daughter watch this all on DVDs, and her two favorite characters were Mr. Spock and also Scotty. And she said the reason she liked Scotty was because he was so sensible. And I thought, there is something about that that's very comforting, to be sensible. Science is, even though there's a lot of counterintuitive discoveries coming out, ultimately, it's a very sensible way of looking at the world. So I kind of take people through the paces of that, how to think about things scientifically, how to do fun things like make estimates on your own. This is something where if you have a grasp of what's around you, if you have a sense of what they call the sample space and are able to make estimates, it's a very powerful tool that you can apply to everything, including you go to the doctor, you get a medical test result, and it comes up positive, and all of a sudden you're about to have, you know, a heart attack. And so here is the kind of information that you can ask or think about that will probably allay your fears about what that actual positive result means. So we did a general thing, also thinking probabilities. One of the things all scientists wish everybody had a better sense of was the likelihood of things happening, what it means for things to happen randomly, what a coincidence is, all of these concepts. Another basic thing is scale. Interestingly, that scientists don't tend to think in the scale of everyday life. They think in the very big or the very long or the very short, very tiny. So how to think about things on scale levels. and then into the individual disciplines. Physics, chemistry, biology, geology, and astronomy. These are the disciplines that most people, I think of as hard or the ones they feel intimidated by, as opposed to the softer sciences, where I didn't think they needed as much of the grounding. So what we tried to do is come up with the canon, the fundamentals of each discipline, not facts, not a list of terms, anything but ideas, the kind of unifying concepts in each discipline. So a few things that, by understanding them, you kind of start to see what's going on. I mentioned the cell in biology. Another example is in geology. What is the Earth? The Earth is this really hot ball in frigid space, and it's trying to get rid of that heat. It's trying to get all the heat coming from the inside and the core and sort of shrugging it out into cold space. And that basic dynamic explains just about everything that you see. And in astronomy, there's some really cool concepts there, obviously, one of them being that most people don't think of, and that is that everything we know about our heavens, everything we know by looking at light. We associate astronomy with the night and with darkness, but in fact, everything we know about our universe, we know by studying light beams. Light beams that have a story to tell about where they come from and where they've been until they've reached us. Another fundamental unifying idea that is cool and always try to keep in mind is that when you look out into the sky, you're looking into the past. It's kind of scary to think that some of the things you're looking at may no longer be there, but it's also the reality. So these are some of the concepts that I try to get across. I try to do it in a very, the way I think about science, you know, sort of the way I try to really metabolize it from the inside out. Everywhere I went, asked scientists, okay, so we're not working on human scale or everyday scale, but let's try to see what would happen if we did, if we had a cell, if we took a cell, tiny, and blew it up to something the size of a desktop accessory, what would it look like? And one of the scientists, I think, had the best answer. She said, oh, she said this kind of happily, it would look like snot. Snot, yeah, it would look like a pump. And it turns out that, why would it look like snot? Well, life, you know, one of the definitions of life by some kind of clever scientist is that, you know, that which is squishy. And in fact, all aspects of life are ultimately very squishy. So if you actually took a cell and blew it up, most of it would feel kind of like goo. And how? What would the proteins feel like? What would they look like? It's kind of cool. They would sort of look like these little Nerf balls with little origami parts. So I'm always trying to give you a sense of, you know, make it into something like you're walking through it, almost like a movie. but ultimately, it really is, I think, about the ideas. I like ideas. This is, I think, what makes science so exciting and why I stick with it is because there are always new ideas coming up. Just today, in fact, I was looking at something that's going to be published about, well, this is not such a happy idea, but it's about female chimpanzees and how there have been observations lately of female-initiated infanticide. Now, normally we associate infanticide with males because males, what males do is they want to kill the young of other males so they get the female back into estrus so that they can mate with her and have their babies. Well, now it looks like the female chimpanzees are committing infanticide against competing females' young for reasons that we, you know, we're going to have to devise some kind of theoretical framework in which to understand it, but it's kind of a new concept. And so these are the kinds of things that are always coming up, exciting new ideas. I like science because it is humans getting it right for a change. It's actually a sense of progress and possibility as opposed to basically just blowing everything up. So I really feel like every time I get depressed, science, you know, scientists can sometimes be sort of like, I've made this comparison before, that science, like Paris, you know, you have to deal with the Parisians. But even though scientists can be very persnickety, and they can be difficult and prima donna-ish because they work in their own little world. Still, ultimately, they are so generous with trying to convey their love of what they do. Now, how often do you talk to people that just love what they do, feel privileged to do it every single day, long days too, but they love it because they feel like it's actually building as opposed to, as I said, tearing down. So you get this sense of optimism from it that I'm trying to encourage in people because I'm not a naturally optimistic person, but through studying science, I feel like it brings me hope for the future. I'm just going to read you a little bit more from my astronomy chapter, and then I will be happy to entertain questions. That's right. You'd think I was usually much more organized, but astronomy is so easy to love. It is filled with outrageous magic that also happens to be true. Novas and supernovas and pulsar stars that spin and click and are as thick as an atomic heart, as thick as Joyce's muster mark, and those thicker, darker collapsed star carcasses we call black holes, which are so dense that even light cannot escape their gravitational grip, and quasars, celestial furnaces at the edge of the known universe that are the size of stars but as luminous as entire galaxies, and theoretical plausibilities like extra dimensions beyond the four we know, or the creasing of space-time into shortcut wormholes, which, if they exist, would be the equivalent of time travel machines. Astronomy is about the heavens, the divinest of final frontiers, and the presumed zip code of Ra, Vishnu, Zeus, Odin, Tezcatlipoca, Yahweh, our Father who art in, and a host of other holy hosts. And that religious resonance markedly broadens the discipline's appeal, making it feel both cozier and more profound than it might otherwise. Astronomy also seems chaster than other sciences, purer of heart, and freer of impurities, mutagens, teratogens, animal testing. Astronomers are like responsible ecotourists, squinting at the scenery through high-quality optical devices, taking nothing but images that may be computer-enhanced for public distribution, leaving nothing but a few Land Rover footprints on faraway Martian soil, and okay, maybe the Land Rover too. Astronomers are pure of heart and appealingly puerile. They look into the midnight sky and ask big questions, just as we did when we were in college. Who are we? Where do we come from? And why are we standing around outside on the night before finals? Do we want to end up like our father and work in a factory or what? I also get into, towards the end of the chapter, so I take us through some of the basics like the Big Bang and how we know the Big Bang is real, what is the evidence for it, and also how we are all made of star stuff and why that is. And then at the end I get into a discussion of what I think of as the most profound issue of all, and that is whether we're alone. And I was much more pessimistic until recently about whether we'd ever be able to communicate with other species, other civilizations, if they're out there. And then I was with the Skyworks at SETI, Seth Shostak, who said that he actually thinks, believe it or not, in the next 10 years, we are going to hear from alien civilizations, that they're actually on their way and they'll have something to say when they get here. Unfortunately, maybe machines, he says, because he actually has this idea that we too are going to, that computers are also going to evolve sentience and end up being the ones who do our traveling for us, which may or may not be a good thing. But in any case, it would be a profound revelation to think that the universe is filled with life, that there are other eyes of the universe looking out there. So I go through some of the steps involved in trying to calculate the probability of things being out there. And end
I'm sorry. Wait.
I'm sorry. I cannot find that last page. Can I see my book? Okay. The person who introduced me. Do you have a copy of my book? Oh, okay, I got it. Okay, so. Take heart. Remember that while our naked night vision is limited mostly to the Milky Way, our sample space is not. Even if there were only one communicative society per galaxy, and that's something that people think is that, you know, basically when you get to the point of being able to communicate, not free, long before you blow yourself up, so there's only going to be one per galaxy. Anyway, that still leaves us with billions of hypothetical entries on the Rolodex of hope. Admittedly, the terrible distances between galaxies could well preclude any communication beyond the science fictional, or maybe not, but it's good to think that they're out there, those probabilistic star-flecked partners in space-time. And who knows? They may be better off than we are and have found the perfect intergalactic wormhole and are steadily heading our way. Please, please, stop by any time, any star date. We can't promise, but we will try with all our heart and hemoglobin and every one of our 90 trillion body cells and our bacterial symbionts, too, to hang on, dodge our own bullets, and be here when you arrive. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Natalie. At this point, we'll take questions. I see a lot of old hands right here in front, the gentleman in the blue. Coming your way.
Would you consider the possibility that the disturbed behavior as shown now by the chimpanzees is the result of man's intrusion on their territory? I say this because I was corresponding with Jane Goodall in 1962 when she was sitting out on a hillside observing them at long distance through binoculars and reported consistently warm, fuzzy, cooperative behavior with some irritability when one troop ran into another troop, but no major crisis anywhere along the line until she set up a research station in the Gombe Preserve and started feeding them bananas, at which point they became mean, competitive, aggressive, and hierarchical, and I think are still showing the same results of our moving in on them.
Well, the problem is that there have been a number of, the chimpanzee research has kind of branched out, and there are many researchers who have their own troops that they've been following in some cases for almost as long as Jane Goodall. So they've been able to get data from many different kinds of environments, many different degrees of interference, the human habitat, the disturbance by humans in their habitat, some of them quite wilderness with really no sign that they would be disturbed by humans. And also the researchers themselves tend to be do not supplement their diet. So they start to gather all that data together and come up with some overarching patterns that they see. And the thing that's interesting about chimpanzees is that on the one hand, there's similarities in behavior. On the other hand, there's a lot of cultural variations. And there have been some papers recently on the fact that, yes, chimpanzees do have culture. They do have variations in how they do certain things from one group to another, like variations in how they greet each other, variations in how the males try to attract the attention of the females. So there is that variation, and it seems to be taught from elders to youngers, or at least it's observed, and it's passed along through the ages, but it's not genetic. So what you start to see are patterns, and one of the patterns that has been observed, really, chimpanzees are not that nice. They are actually quite warlike, and one of the things that Jane Goodall first started observing, apart from any kind of supplemental feeding she was doing, was the equivalent of genocide, that one group, the males, would systematically wipe out the males and sometimes the females too of a competing neighboring group. So they are pretty aggressive and not necessarily very, nothing that you necessarily want to imitate or sort of write an etiquette book based on. So I think that in the case of these female-led infanticide, that it will probably turn out to be for good Darwinian reason that they're doing it. And Darwin, I think, ultimately is right about, you know, why would you behave in a given way? Well, if it's going to further your cause genetically and also your power alliances with the animals nearest to you, there's reason to do it. It's going to get done. So, you know, we can sort of come up with a genetic explanation for both good and bad behavior, but ultimately, most things make sense when you start to understand them in the framework of Darwinism. So I have not read this new report. I don't know how good the data are. I don't know how widespread this phenomenon is. I just know that this, along with the fact that female chimpanzees also do this kind of hunting where they kill, you know, they kill these little prosimian things, bush babies. They take sticks and they use tools to hunt them. This is another new observation about their behavior. Shows that there's a lot going on and that females can be pretty aggressive.
Another question. In the red about 10 rows back, Barbara.
I was going to, as a scientist who loves science as much as you do, I was going to ask how you became interested in science, but I decided that really the more important question, if you care to comment on it, is what can we do to get kids in school excited, since we have such a dearth of people going into science now?
This is, of course, a question that comes up all the time, and I think what we have to do is start having more programs where scientists go into the schools and take kids out in the field and do experiments with them. Somebody else mentioned today birding, that's a way to involve citizens in science, and that's one thing. And in Maryland, where I live, they have this program where they take all Maryland kids out for like overnights in the field and have them learn about Maryland ecology. We need to do more of that, because I think that every scientist I've ever known got interested in science because of doing science, getting some hands-on experience, just being able to get out there and get your hands dirty, roll up your sleeves, all of that. And I think that if scientists were to do more of that, one of the problems, I think, is that scientists don't get rewarded enough for that kind of activity the way they do for publishing reports and getting grant money coming in. But we have to, as a society, make these decisions collectively that this is what we want to encourage. We keep talking about it, though, and nobody's just like the weather. Nobody's doing anything. So I don't know. I think it's tragic. But it's the sort of thing that only as a society can we come up with solutions. It can't be a kind of a stopgap thing.
Another question. Gentleman in the blue? Sure, but we want to keep this focused on questions, so if you can keep it brief. Sure.
I would agree that the scientists have a love for science, but I also think that a lot of the practicing scientists do not spend time nurturing science educators. People who are not going to do science in a laboratory, but are going to do it with kids.
Yes, I agree.
And I think until that happens, it's not going to get down to the level that we're looking for.
We don't seem to respect educators enough. I don't know how many people saw that movie Sideways, but I was very disappointed that main character, I mean, he was a wino, but he considered himself a failure because he taught high school English and creative writing. It's like, that's like nothing compared to being a novelist, or, you know, that this is the kind of work that you do when you can't do anything else, and that we actually have that attitude towards teachers, and then we wonder why the children aren't learning, or what was it that Bush said? He said, are the children learning? Now I'm beginning to sound like him. But no, I think that You know, we have to have... Oh, another thing that we don't do very well in this country is we don't seem to respect signs of great education. Look what happened with Clinton. Bill Clinton. Now, this is a smart guy. He really was smart. And if you ever saw him in action, for example, I saw him at a genetics meeting. He absorbed things like that, was able to synthesize all this new information and immediately start asking these kinds of questions. I mean, he's a really well-educated guy, very smart. When he gets on the campaign trail, he has to act like he's like none of this ever happened, and that he's just one of these good old boys, and he can't show that, he can't be proud and say, here I am, I'm a really well-educated person who really values education. That's somehow seen as elitism. And then we want our kids to be well-educated. Well, it's just, it's so contradictory, and we seem to have all these mixed messages. We don't respect teachers, but teachers have to, we have to test for, make sure they're doing a good job. We want our kids to be educated, but we hate elitists who seem overly, effetely educated. You know, as I said, it has to be a social-wide movement to affect change, and I don't know who's going to lead that. Maybe the next president.
We can start it this evening. Yeah, quick question over here.
As a comment, I heard Philip Glass about 2 weeks ago talk about the lack of young people going into music and the arts. Mm-hmm. So I wonder where they're going if they're not...
into finance.
But the question I had for you is, having read a couple of your books and seen you last at Penn, there you had a critical look at science. Has the culture changed in a way that requires us to pay an honorific attention to science? Science is in the midst of controversy. The last time I was here was a bishop and theologian talking about the relation between science and religion. Why is your book focused as it is on the joys of science?
Because I feel that we need that.
And not a critical,
yeah.
What happened to the critical look at it?
Well, I think that that's a good point, and I have in the past been more critical and said, oh, well, we have to get to the point where we can criticize science the same way art critics criticize art, and you don't just sort of serve as a kind of a cheerleader for science. And I have to say that all science writers felt the same way, that we had to evolve towards being more skeptical about a lot of the claims, and we are. But at the same time, all of us are getting into this panic because what we see happening to the scientific enterprise here is it's just like dissolving before our eyes, and we all ultimately really love it. We don't want the United States to become like a second-tier scientific force in the world, and yet you're starting to see the signs of that happening. So I think we all feel like we have to keep this... convey some of our enthusiasm for it. So I guess being critical of it is kind of a luxury of good times. This was the time when the NIH budget was flourishing instead of sort of being narrowed. This was a time when we didn't have to worry that they were going to go, politicians were making scientific decisions and interfering with the course of research done at the EPA or USDA or wherever. This is a time when perhaps it was just in more stable condition than it is now. Patient is critical, so we all feel like we have to keep it alive.
Another question, gentleman right here.
Obviously, you've been writing about science for a long time, but I was wondering, when you interviewed the scientists for your book, did anything stand out as real surprises to you?
Yes, that actually some of them are quite well-dressed. I mean, I'm really... This one guy could tie a really good Windsor knot. I think what surprised me was how pleading they were that, for certain things that they wish people understood about science, and one of the biggies being that science is not a dry body of facts and that people have to see that science is a way of looking at the world. We kept hearing this. It was like as though everybody was reading from some kind of script. It was amazing to me to start to feel like your eyes kind of start to glaze over because they go into the spiel. But it's because they all are, as I say, there's some sense of desperation out there. They want people to be like Scotty and be sensible. And so I think that the surprise is how they all seem to be speaking with one voice.
Next question. Gentleman in the red, about 10 rows back.
If you were having beer with the three Republican candidates who recently said that they don't believe in evolution, what would you tell them?
I'm sorry, if I were in the room with them?
No, having a beer.
Oh, having a beer with them?
Yeah. Let's get down to it.
Why would I do that?
Because you're going to be in an informal setting, you're not on the stage, and you're just really talking them down to earth. What would you talk to them? What would you discuss with them about evolution?
I would ask them if their kids ever had head lice, and I'd say, well, how can anybody deny evolution when it's happening all around us? How could anybody deny that, oh, you know, if your kid has head lice and you put some of these shampoos, these supposedly lysicidal shampoos on them, they don't work because they've all evolved this resistance to it. And same with a lot of the antibiotics. You know, I mean, if you're infected with a virus, it's mutating within you. How can you deny that evolution happens when on an everyday short scale like that it's happening? And also, when you look at how similar our parts are. I mean, if you compare the hand of a human with this thing in the flipper of a penguin, or you look at a whale or anything you look at, you see these patterns coming up. We're all connected. And so how could you possibly, you know, one of the scientists said it kind of takes almost a malign intent to ignore all that. But maybe it's just a line. Maybe it's just a pose. Maybe it's just like you have to kind of declare your allegiance to a very radical right wing of the party. And this is one of the kind of the little clues, the kind of the keys. It's almost like the early Christians having the fish. You know, this is just, maybe it doesn't really mean anything. I don't know. I would have not been so worried because, you know, Reagan had he questioned a lot of things that were kind of silly, but ultimately he actually chose decent people to run the different scientific agencies. And so I thought, okay. But then Bush comes along and he kind of interferes at a level you would not believe that you think it's not possible, but they are. They're infiltrating every level of government and scientific operations. So I'm not so optimistic that it can be benign. So I hope that none of those three guys gets elected, please.
Another question. Gentleman in back in the brown.
I'm curious about your day-to-day at the Times, whether or not you're given specific things to research, or whether you're given free rein, or whether that's changed since the Pulitzer.
Well, right now, you know, I write this column called Basics, and it's about kind of like the book in that it's trying to get at some of the basics that people don't necessarily know or may have forgotten, like what is a plant, or, you know, why we have equinox, that kind of thing. One of the things I'm working on now, which I think is kind of fun, you know, you can kind of take something in the news and do a riff on it. So I'm working now on a piece about, so the queen is here visiting, so I'm writing something about queen bees. And also the idea, okay, so of course we're all concerned now about bees because there's this, you know, vanishing population, a half of bees are disappearing and we don't know where they're going. So I'll talk about that. And there's also some interesting work being done on the bee genome, mapping out all the bee genes and trying to associate them with different behaviors. And it's perhaps less incendiary to do that with a bee than it would be to do it with us or even a mammal. So there's a big effort underway now to assign specific genetic, you know, markers with certain kinds of behaviors. So I like being able to do that. But, I mean, it's hard because one of the things is you're really, the relentless kind of criticism you get, well, this is true everywhere, every blogs and people writing in emails and so on. And it's kind of hard to kind of not get a little sensitive about it. But I think I have a lot of fun with it. I really do. I really like being able to come up with an idea that's related to the news, but give it a novel twist, not just do something that's just the news.
Couple more questions. Oh, I see a lot of hands, though. Gentleman about 10 rows back in the jacket.
On the subject of ethics and bioethics and honesty of data reporting of scientists, the Helsinki Declaration was several years ago, and most scientists think that it was a necessary thing to do. But as people interviewed scientists in various laboratories, they found out that barely 55% of the scientists interviewed had ever heard of the Helsinki Declaration. Would you care to comment on that, the question of bioethics, and is the Helsinki Declaration usable or necessary, or is it just obsolete already?
You know something? I'm a brave person, and I'm going to admit that I do not know what the Helsinki Declaration is. Can you tell us what it is?
It has to do with the relationship that scientists have with their peers and with their superiors in creating a published report, which is clearly reproducible by another scientist in another laboratory or in another country. And many of the scientific labs that have inventions or new science on the forefront do not want to have that type of free publication for commercial reasons.
Okay.
So the Helsinki Declaration required scientists to have a certain amount of abilities to publish their findings so that other scientists, if they wanted to, could have a reproducible experiment.
One of the things that's related to that that's going on now is Harold Varmus has tried to actually... When he was the head of the National Institutes of Health, he tried to instigate a lot of changes in getting scientists to agree to put all, you know, I mean, for example, the Human Genome Project, make sure that everything that they did was going to be put into the public database that would then be accessible to anybody who cared to use it, as opposed to keeping a lock on it to try to get a patent on it while you could. He also has tried to start up public journals in which results would get published in these journals and be accessible to anybody to read if they care to, because if you look at any of the major journals, Science and Nature, subscriptions are hundreds of dollars a year. So what we end up doing as taxpayers is we support science with our tax dollars, and then if we want to see the fruits of that effort, we have to pay again to these very expensive journals. And so he was trying to get scientists to agree to publish in his public journals instead. PLOS, P-L-O-S, is a whole series of them. It's met with mixed success because there's this incredible infrastructure in place now where, you know, you have to get your results out in the most prestigious platform possible, and that's going to be one of these journals. And there's also increasing pressure, and I can't tell you how great it is to patent, to file patents on things, to hold back things until you can get your patent out there, sometimes so quickly that you don't even know what you're patenting. Why is there so much pressure on scientists to do this? Because there's decreasing public financing of research. So there's all of this competition going on with the journals, with the need to privatize, to come up with these public-private partnerships. One of the amazing things to me is that Congress has spent a lot of time lately going after NIH scientists who are not abiding by this, you know, conflict of interest resolution. At the same time, they're saying you guys have to sort of work with private enterprise, but they're also making sure that they can't profit from it and they're going to jeopardize their career. So everybody's kind of crazy with what to do about keeping science open and accessible versus people being able to profit off of it. And this is something that is still, I mean, this is very much in flux. So I don't know what's going to happen on a national level, but I do know, I mean, international level, but I do know that on a national level, there is enormous pressure on scientists to get with the program of privatization. And I don't know what's going to happen, because one of the things that's great about science is that it is this kind of free form of sharing of information, and that has been the abiding ethic of it until very recently. And it would be a shame if it changed. And maybe that's part of the reason why things are in bad shape now, is that it is in this state of crisis and change.
Folks, why don't we continue the conversation upstairs? Please thank Natalie Anger.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.